I want to begin with not really a correction, but I'll state it that way. Because it's not a correction to anything that I wrote down. It's just a correction to one of the remarks that I made. For the theory of the conductor, pi must be generic. There was some discussion at the end whether if the representation was non-generic, you could use the fact that every generic representation is the quotient of an induced and get the theory of the conductor for that. And I went and looked up the paper, and there is a comment at the end, and it says it has to be generic. So pi must be generic. If pi is not generic, you can still define its conductor by epsilon s pi psi by doing what we did before. And then what was it? Q to the minus f of pi s minus a half, I believe. You can still define that integer that way. And you can still define this. And there will be no k1 p of t fixed vectors for t less than f pi, but there may not be any at f pi. Okay, so this was sort of the question that was asked. At f pi, you may have fixed vectors, but do you know they live in the quotient? And the answer is no, you don't. Okay, so there will be no fixed vectors for t less than that, but there may not be any fixed vectors at that level. No, this is in the space of pi. This is in the space of pi. In the space of pi. Right. And the example, and I'll let you work this out, is to take pi to be chi of the determinant and think about what happens there. Okay. Once you start taking determinants, you're not going to see any of this congruence, really. And so that was one correction to things that I said, not things. I think that what I wrote is still fine, but there was a question that I misanswered at some point. Okay. Then, is that okay? More or less? And I don't know. That's my safe answer. The question is, if I take pi that's not generic, and so I write it as the Langlands quotient of an induced, right? And I look at that, do this and look at the conductor given by this, will that induced representation have a vector fixed under this group? So even though the quotient might not, could there be one somewhere else deeper in the induced representation? And I don't know. Okay. The real topic of today is the unramified calculation. And this is actually really quite a pretty calculation. We'll go through most of this. So K is a non-Archimedean local field. I think we've mainly been dealing with p-adic field, so characteristic zero, though it doesn't really matter here. It's got a ring of integers, maximal ideal, and pi is going to be the uniformizer. And then my representation pi is going to be irreducible, admissible, generic, and unramified representation of GLN. And mainly we're just going to talk about this for a long time, but at the end of the day, I'll also need a similar thing for GLM. Okay. And I'll probably forget to identify it when I get there. So this is going to be the setting. And what we eventually want to do, so W naught in the Whitaker model will be the K fixed, K always GL in O, the maximal compact, the K fixed Whitaker function. And what we wanted, and the real thing that we want today is to show that the unramified L function is equal to the local integral computed with the K-fixed Whitaker functions, and we also want an explicit formula. So we want both of these things. We're really going to compute this integral and get an explicit formula for it and then say why that's actually the L function. So we will compute the L function in this case. Now, to do this, I first need to tell you some facts about unramified generic representations of GLN. Now, here's a fact, here's a structural fact, which my guess is due to Jacquet, but I don't really know. And that is, if pi is unramified and generic, then in fact, and also irreducible admissible, in fact, it is a full induced from the Borel of unramified characters. So each mu I is an unramified character of GL1, which is K cross. Okay, so I just put n characters on the Borel, the upper triangular subgroup, and I induce it up. Normalized induction. Okay. Well, yeah, this is one of those things. So I'm sure it's in Bernstein and Zelovinsky. Yes. I don't know if this is one of those things that was actually done earlier by Jacquet with all of this. So I don't really, that's why I said I wasn't really sure. So it could be Jacquet, could be Bernstein. It's definitely in Bernstein and Zelovinsky, if nowhere else. Okay. Now, since K cross can be written as basically powers of omega times the units, okay, and each mu I being unramified is invariant under the units, okay, that's what it means for the character to be unramified. And then this is just powers of a single element. Each character is completely, once I know it's unramified, it's completely determined by its value on the uniformizer, which is a complex number. Okay? If I know it's unramified and I know that number, I know the character. Okay? So pi is completely determined by this set of complex numbers. Okay, that's just a set of complex numbers. And there are various ways of encoding them. One way of encoding them is to put these in a matrix. So that's in GLNC, or you could even think of the conjugacy class of this sitting inside of GLNC. This is conjugacy class. So it's determined by either one of these pieces of information. They're all equivalent, more or less. Okay? And these are the so-called the satake parameters of pi in a very hands-on way. That's what they are. It's these n complex numbers. They tell me that representation, because they tell me the characters. It's an irreducible induced from these characters. Once I know the characters, I know the representation, essentially. Okay. So these are the Satake parameters. Okay. And so our computation here, our explicit formula is going to be in terms of these numbers. Okay. Now, since pi is unramified, there will be a unique up to scalars k fixed vector. And right now I'm going to call it V naught in the space of pi, so the space of that induced representation. Okay. Now recall, last time we said our tool here is going to be the unramified Hecke algebra. So recall that we have the unramified Hecke algebra, and this is the space of smooth functions, so locally constant functions of compact support on GLN, which are bi-invariant under the maximal compact. Okay? And this is commutative and generated by these functions that I called phi I. These are functions on G, and what they are the characteristic functions of, I take the compact, so I'm, whether I use K or GLNO, I know I'm going to be inconsistent, so. And then I take the diagonal matrix that has the uniformizer I times, and then 1 the rest of the time. So this is a characteristic function of this double coset. It is bi K invariant, and it's smooth of compact support. And it's generated by these, and here's another sort of error. Actually, what I said was fine, because I said this was generated by this, and then everyone yelled at me because I had one too many generators, and I cut off the last one, and that is not correct. You have to cut off the first one. So that's to make Milab happy now that he's gone. Okay? And now if you remember from what we talked about the Hecke algebra from before, this actually acts as projections onto the k-fixed vectors. Okay, so these sort of as projections. Not quite correct. So, if I take something, anything from this Hecke algebra, and I act on V naught with it, remember this is the integral over GLNK of phi G pi G V naught. When I do this, I get back a K fixed vector, but there's only one up to scalars, and so this is some constant multiple of V naught, where lambda, this is a, I guess I should put lambda pi, it doesn't depend on the representation. This is a complex number, and in fact, one can check that if you look at this as a function on the Hecke algebra, this is a character of this spherical Hecke algebra as a convolution algebra. Okay. So in some sense, you should think of the lambda pi of the generators. These are sort of the Hecke eigenvalues for pi or this fixed vector. Okay? So that this is in this setting, these are the heck, this is my V naught is my heck eigenfunction. These are my heck eigenvalues. Okay? Okay. So it turns out the first step in doing this calculation is to determine what these heck eigenvalues are in terms of these parameters. So that's the first thing we're going to do. Okay? That's the first thing we're going to do. So as a first step, we will compute the heck eigenvalues lambda pi of these generators in terms of these Satake parameters. Okay? And the point is, we can do this because for the induced representation, we have a model. We have an explicit model for this induced representation. Okay, we know how it transforms. Yes? What? Well, yes, because the point is, this is still, if I act by the compact, right, this is K invariant. Right? So it's still, the point is, this is still a K fixed vector, and there's only one up to scalars. And then the fact that it's it preserves convolution is just a calculation here. So yeah, it's because there's a unique up to scalars k-fixed vector. Okay? So we have an explicit model for this, and hence an explicit formula for, and now I'm going to call it F naught of G, the k-fixed function. In the induced, representation. Okay? So if we write G as, I want to write it as NAK, where N is in the translations. Oops. Oh! Well, I finally did it, but that's okay. That K and that K are not the same K. That's the field. Well, so let's just leave the field off. Let's just say it's in there. A is diagonal, and K is in the maximal compact. Oh, okay. Then F naught of G, which is F naught of NAK. Well, to say that it's induced from those characters, first off, it's trivial here. If it's fixed under the compact, it's trivial here. And so all I have to know is what happens on the diagonal. And on the diagonal, it transforms by those characters, except this is unitary induction. So there's a modulus factor that comes out. So let me write this as delta. So this is the modulus character. And then I get mu1a1 mu n an F naught of the identity. Okay, and so we can assume that this is normalized so that on the identity it's 1. Okay, so that tells me what this function looks like. But I can compute what the action of one of these operators are in this model. So let's compute one of our generators. So we're going to compute this. On the one hand, this is going to be lambda pi, right? Just by definition. On the other hand, it is so by definition, pi phi I f naught of the identity is what's the integral phi over gln phi of g pi of g f naught at e. This is just right translation, and this is just the characteristic function of that set. So this is really just the integral over k, well, over this double coset. I'll explain this notation right now. I've gotten myself a little bit out of order here. Okay? Where this is that double cosine. Okay? Now, to do this calculation, I'd be much happier if that g was written in Iwasawa coordinates so that I would have this formula. Okay? So to continue, I need to write this double coset in terms of right cosets. And if you're familiar with classical Heck algebra in terms of double cosets, this is a standard computation. It's one you've probably seen. Okay? So to do this, now I'll explain that notation. If I take an n-tuple of integers, I want to let pi to the capital J be the matrix, the diagonal matrix consisting of those powers of the uniformizer. Okay? So that so if I let eta I be the vector that has I ones in the beginning and then zeros, then phi I is the characteristic function of k pi to the eta I k. So that's that notation that I used up there. I was just going with the flow and didn't get introduced what I needed to. Okay? Okay, so I need to, this is really the double coset I need to decompose. To do that, I'm going to do the following thing. I'm going to let I sub I be the set of all vectors of length n with the property that the entries are either 0 or 1 and their sum is I. And for each one of these vectors, I'm going to let n o epsilon be n o. So this is just n is the upper triangular group. These are the integral points of the upper triangular group intersect pi e k pi minus epsilon. Okay, so this is some, this sits inside the integral points of the translation of finite index. Okay? It's basically saying I have to have some pi's in. Some of those entries have to be divisible by pi up there. Okay. And then here is the theorem. Well, not really a theorem. It's just a little lemma. And it says that this double coset, and I'm not going to prove this, although if you do GL2 and phi1, you'll get the usual representatives of the Hecke operator at P out of this. It's the union over all these sequences, and then the union over all n, and the quotient of this by this. Of n pi epsilon. Okay. That's just a computation. It's somewhat classical computation, actually. But I'm not. There's going to be a number of little calculations like this, which I'm not going to do, and this is one of them. You can do the n equals 2 calculation in the privacy of your own little, wherever you like to do these things. But I will not do it in public for several reasons. One, it would take too long. And two, I would make enough mistakes that it would just be completely confusing. Okay, but if we now come back to our calculation, right, this is just now the sum over these epsilons, the sum over these n's, F naught of n pi to the epsilon, and the k goes out. That's just it. It's just that. Right? Because the k is gone, because that thing's k invariant. Okay? And what is this? Well, now I can use my formula. Okay? The n comes out. Okay, this remains, so it's the sum, epsilon and I sub I. This doesn't affect anything, so I get the cardinality of this set. So that's gone. Here I get this modulus function for this diagonal element. And then I get the characters. Okay, so let me express that as the product J equals 1 to N. Mu I pi to the epsilon. Ooh, this better be a J and that better be a J. Okay. That's this. Right? Because when you do parabolic induction, right, it's this induced representation says it's invariant, completely invariant. Under the translations, on the diagonal elements, it transforms by this character. And then on the K, since this one is K fixed, for this one, the K doesn't matter. Okay, but that's just the definition of induction, is that it's invariant under the translations on the left. Okay? And now, here's another one of these little lemmas. The lemma is that if you actually compute this number, it's actually independent of epsilon. It's q to the I n minus I. So that's another little computation that I will not do for you. And if you look at what this is, what is this? This is all products of the epsilon i's are either 0 or 1, and they sum to I. This is all products of I choices of the mu i's at pi. Right? So I take those products, I sum them. This, it turns out, then, is equal to qi n minus I. And this sum is the elementary symmetric polynomial in v these n complex numbers. So this is the ith elementary symmetric polynomial in the Satake parameters. By definition, that's what that is. Okay? And so that's our first result. So let me just stick it up here. So actually, did I just cover up the other thing I wanted? So in some sense, I've done this calculation twice. This thing tells me that whatever this number is, it's the eigenvalue, and this gives me an explicit calculation of that in terms of these elementary symmetric polynomials. So that's our first theorem. And it says that the Hecke eigenvalues are essentially the same thing or related to the Satake parameters. And so these are sometimes called Hecke-Satake parameters. I mean, it's all the same information. Okay, so that's a nice, I mean, there's nothing hard about this little calculation, modulo these little computational facts, that for one of these unramified representations, the Hecke eigenvalues are expressible as the elementary symmetric polynomials in the Satake parameters. Really elementary. Modulo these little calculations. Okay. Now that's supposed to stay up there for later use, so if I pull that down and go to erase it, someone should yell at me. Okay. So that's good. That tells me what the eigenvalue is from computing in this model. Now, to do the unramified calculation, what I need is not just the eigenvalue, but this integral involves the unramified Whittaker functions. So I would now like a formula for the unramified Whittaker functions. Okay? Now, I told you last week that this calculation, there'd be two things going on. One, we would require something to be a Hecke eigenfunction. Okay? That's my Hecke eigenfunction. Is the k-fixed vector? They're my Hecke eigenvalues. I've used that. Okay? The other thing I said we would need to use would be the recursion relation among the Hecke operators. Okay? So now what I'm going to do is essentially use the analog of those recursion relations and the fact that I know this eigenvalue already to compute a formula for the Whittaker functions. Okay? And this is essentially due to Shintani, this calculation. So. Okay. So I want to know, so to compute my integral, I want a formula for the unramified Whittaker function. So I need to, this could very well depend on my choice of character, so I'm going to choose psi such that it's trivial on the integers, that's unramified, and such that as soon as you get off the integers, it's non-trivial. So it's non-trivial on the inverse of the uniformizer, so that's outside of the integers. So I take my character to be that. Okay. Yes. Then again, by Iwasawa, I'm going to write G again as translation diagonal compact. And if I think about it, where A I can take to B, well, so this is just diagonal entries. The diagonal entries are elements in the multiplicative group of the field. Those are either powers of the uniformizer times units, but the units are actually in K, and everything's invariant by those. So when I do this, I can really take this to be one of these. So pi to the J1 down to pi to the Jn. Okay? Because those units are in K. Okay. So, if I want to know what this is, so it's in pi j k, it's invariant under k, transforms by the character under n, I essentially have to know its value on these diagonal elements. Okay? I essentially have to know its value on these diagonal elements. Okay, so that's what we're going to compute. Now, the first point is that, remember we had an argument for GL2 that said if you looked at a Whitaker function on the diagonal, that as the roots got big, it had to vanish. We did this by bringing if it's K invariant, we brought in a translation matrix in the compact on one side, moved it through the diagonal, and took it out with the character on the other side. And it was invariant on the one hand, but it gave you a character on the other, and we saw what that said. Okay? So that argument and this is where this choice of character comes in that gave us that W of A is zero for the simple roots large now gives that W naught, so this is equal to zero unless J1 is bigger than J2 is bigger than Jn. And again, to see that, you bring in an integral translation matrix on the right, you move it through, you see what character comes out on the left, and you get that the function has to be zero unless this condition is satisfied. All right. So that will be important for us. And I think now we're ready to do the calculation. Is that right? Yes. So we can now calculate. This is the... where's Asghari today? Okay. Well, he was the one that asked, where's the recursion? And this is going to be the recursion. Okay. So we now, what we're going to repeat our calculation. We're going to compute pi of phi I of W naught evaluated at pi of the J. We're going to do that calculation. Okay? This is going to give us a recursion for these values is what's going to come out of this. So on the one hand, well, this is just some incarnation of the unramified vector in this representation. So acting by this thing in the spherical Hecke algebra on this vector gives me that eigenvalue. Right? I mean, that's just... So pi phi I, W naught really of anything... is lambda pi okay? And now, as before, this was an abstract statement. Now this has content because this is that. This is a computed thing. Okay, so this is q to the I n minus I sigma I mu 1 of pi mu n of pi W naught pi j. Okay. On the other hand, we can do the calculation. We just do the calculation. Well, it's the integral, again, over the same double coset of, well, the action of the group here is right translation. So W naught omega j g dg. Okay? That's just the definition of that action in this model. Okay? And now I use exactly the same decomposition of this double coset into single cosets that I did before. So this is then equal to the sum epsilon nii, the sum in this finite quotient W naught pi j n, sorry, that's a capital J, n pi n pi omega pi epsilon, that's it. Right? Because the K is gone because this is the K invariant Whitaker function. And this is the sum. Well, this gets conjugated past here and out with the character. So psi of pi j n pi to the minus j w naught at pi to the j plus epsilon. Okay. And now, since in whatever this representative is, it has integer entries and j1 is bigger than or equal to and bigger than or equal to jn, because otherwise this is zero. I mean, I'm computing it on those guys. This implies, if you do the calculation, this is also has integer entries. Right? In some sense, that was that compatibility condition that I talked about up there. If it has integer entries, it can come in on the right because of K fixed. I move it past, this is exactly what I get. So it has to be, so the character has to be trivial here. Okay. So this just gives me that cardinality. Okay. So this is equal to the sum epsilon in this set, the cardinality of this once again, and then W naught pi to the J plus epsilon, which is almost the recursion that I want. Well, it's almost the end of the calculation, but I want to replace this cardinality by its value in the little calculation that we did before. And remember, this times the modulus character gave us that factor of q to the I, n minus I up there. So this is that times the inverse of the modular function. So this is q to the I, n minus I, sum, now the modulus character to the minus 1/2, because I have to take it out, okay? So that's one calculation. Here's the other calculation of exactly the same thing, and so if I combine this and this, we get our recursion, which I'm going to write up here as theorem 2. Notice that I have this q to the I, n minus I in both cases. So let me get rid of that, and I get that the symmetric function times the value of the function is the sum epsilon in the set, a modulus character, and then the value of this function on pi j shifted by epsilon. That's a recursion. Yes. I have a typo. So that's my recursion, okay, because it expresses the value here in terms of these, in some sense, higher values. Okay. Now, even though J satisfies this positivity condition, some of these may not, so some of these terms may actually be zero, but that doesn't matter. The formula is still fine. That's my recursion. Okay, are we all right here? Now we're going to solve it. And actually the solution is quite pretty. But you will have to take a few more things on faith, but that's okay. So we will now solve this recursion. And we're going to solve it using finite dimensional representation theory of GLNC. Okay. And the observation is that the sequences J that are decreasing like this are precisely the highest weights for finite dimensional representations of GLNC. Okay. I mean, they are. In particular, so here's an example. If I take eta I, which remember had a bunch of ones, I of them, and then a bunch of zeros, this is the highest weight for the ith exterior power of the standard representation of GLNC. Okay, so there's a finite dimensional representation attached to that parameter, and it is the exterior, ith exterior power of the standard representation is this GLNC acting on C to the N by matrix multiplication. That's all that is. Okay. Now, there are lots of things known about these. So, and about these representations. So, and I'm not going, this is the stuff that you've either seen or you will have to take it on faith. So for such a J, I'm going to let rho J be the corresponding complex, corresponding finite dimensional representation of GLN over the complexes now. Okay? So I'm not doing p-adic fields. I'm doing complex representation theory. And I'm going to let chi of j be the trace of rho j, the character. This is finite dimensional representation theory. Okay? And there are lots known about these things. Okay? So, for example, from the decomposition of the tensor product of two finite dimensional representations of GLN, we obtain a formula for chi eta I times chi j. So this is chi, this is the character of trace. So this is trace of that exterior power tensored with whatever the representation of highest weight J is, there's a formula for this. And lo and behold, it's the sum epsilon in I sub I of the character of the representation of highest weight J plus epsilon. And if J plus epsilon is not a highest weight, so it's no longer positive, this is taken to be zero. Okay? Now this should look something like that up there. Okay? And in fact, these are characters, right? These are characters of finite dimensional representations. They're class functions. It makes sense to evaluate them on matrices. Okay? So since the chi, j are class functions, we can evaluate on, well, a pi. That's a complex matrix, diagonal. And, well, if you take the ith exterior power of the standard representation and you evaluate it on a diagonal matrix, right, if you think about what ith exterior powers do for you, this is precisely the isometric function in the entries of that diagonal matrix. Okay? Using this. Using that we know what this is. Well, but then this thing gives that sigma I mu 1 pi down to mu n pi times, well, whatever chi j evaluated on a pi is the sum chi j plus epsilon evaluated on a pi. Well, if you now compare that recursion with this recursion, right, combining these two things, we then obtain. So that's the recursion I want to solve. This is a recursion that I sort of, I mean, it's basically the same recursion, and I know what the solutions to it are. Right? This is a well-defined function here. So I only have to worry about that little modulus factor, and so what you get is that this is equal to, well, there's going to be chi j at a pi, and then I have to do something to compensate for that, and it's just, I put in the modulus character at pi j. That's the solution to the recursion. Okay. Notice that a couple of things have happened. Here it's the function that depends on pi, and it's the argument that depends on j. Here it's the function that depends on j and the argument that depends on pi. Things have been sort of swapped. Really nice. Okay? So there I've done everything that I told you I was going to do. I have Hecke eigenfunctions, computed their Hecke eigenvalues, taken the recursion that came out of the Hecke operators, and solved them. Okay? So that's all the classical steps you do for computing the Euler factor done in this land. Okay. Well, you can just, if you take this factor and you multiply it, I just looked at that and I looked at this and I said, there's my solution. I just really compared them. Yeah. Yeah, it's really sort of just sort of amazing. It's really quite pretty. And the thing is, we haven't done anything subtle. We just computed these things in a couple of different models for this representation. There's been nothing really subtle. Well, see, I've got a delta factor up there, right? And so if I multiply by this factor here, right? So if I multiply this whole thing by this factor, right? Then this gets in here. This gets in here. Oh. No, I want to multiply this by that factor. Yeah, there's some. Yeah, it's a character, so it cancels. I mean, and now I seem to have it. Yeah, so I multiply this by omega, this delta, this by the corresponding for delta for this, but it is a character, and so it will then cancel. Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. So this calculation of the Whitaker function for GLN is due to Shintani. There's a general version of it for let G be quasi-split group due to Castleman and Shalika. Okay. So finally, calculating the integral. That's our last step. Okay. So what is the integral that we want to calculate? S W naught W naught W prime naught, which is the integral GLM K over GLM NM. And let's see, I have W naught evaluated on H and then the identity. W prime naught, eval, W naught prime, whatever it is, W prime naught, absolute determinant H to the S minus M over 2 dH. Okay. That's what I want to compute. Now, I'm going to use Iwasawa once again. So again, right, because I know these functions on the diagonal things. I know, well, the unipotent parts are gone anyway, and they're both invariant under the compact, right? So I'm just going to use Iwasawa. I'm going to write G as N pi to some power K, okay? But now I do have to worry about how my integral changes. So it turns out dG then becomes dN, which in some sense is already gone because I'm on the quotient. And then I get delta, this is on GLM, so delta to the minus a half pi j dk. Okay, so that's the way the measure changes. Since I'm not very good at measuring things, let me make sure. Wrong. Well, there's no dA because the A parts become discrete. Right? The A is sort of discrete. So, and this is a modulus factor to the minus 1. Okay? So we put this in. I'm just going to call this psi for now. And I'm left with the sum over all j, and this is now nz to the m. I have a couple of things going on here. I've done a calculation that I did up here for GLN. I'm applying it here for GLN and here for GLM. Okay, so there are various n's and m's that I have to be worried about here. And this j right? This H is in GLM, so this is a vector of length M. Okay, so this is in ZM. I get W naught pi j I n minus m, W prime naught at pi j, modulus character for m pi j. That's from the measure. What am I missing? Oh, that's right. Oh, and then the determinant, I have to take the determinant of this, and the determinant of this is q to the minus sum of things in j. So let me write this as q to the minus length of j, s minus n minus m over 2, where it's just the sum of the entries. So that's just doing the change of variables and integrating out the compact. So I haven't done anything yet. And I haven't put my formula in yet. Okay. But I do want to note that if I look at the Whitaker function on GLM, this is 0 unless J1 is bigger than J2 is bigger than JM. And in fact, if I look at the thing on GLN, these are still powers of pi. They're just to the zero power. So this is equal to zero unless J1 is bigger than JM, and that has to be bigger than or equal to zero. Okay. All right, now I want to use my formula. Huh? No, because 1 is pi to the 0. The j is the exponents. Okay. Now I'm going to put my formulas in and use this. So I now have the sum, and I have J1 bigger than JM bigger than 0. Okay, so the first one gives me chi. Now I have to worry because that's on GLN. So that J there has length N. This J has length M. So I'm going to put J0. This means that's of length M. Here I fill it out to be of length n with zeros. A pi delta bn to the minus 1/2 pi j 1. For my other one, I have chi j a pi prime. So that's pi prime is also induced from certain characters. So that's the Satake parameters for that. Delta bm to the minus 1/2 pi j. So that's my formulas, and then I have q to the minus j s minus m over 2. And then here's a little lemma. Really, it's just a calculation. If you take, oops, I lost something. There's that up there. I lost that factor up there. So, what happened here? Oh, these are plus.
These are plus, and then you get a minus.
So that's a plus, but when I take that plus and that minus, I get a minus there. Sorry. But that's now is correct. And the amazing thing is that if you compute what this is, you get precisely q to the minus j n minus m over 2. And it is what it is, and that is what it is. Which says, now here I have a negative and a negative, so it basically says that this and this kill this. And so I'm left with the sum J1 JM bigger than or equal to 0 chi J and 0 A pi chi J A pi prime Q to the minus length of J to the S. And now, if you're a whiz on the representation theory of GLN, you say, okay, we're done. Because all we're going to do now is use three facts from either the representation theory of GLN or classical invariant theory. But this is now a formula. This is a formula in terms of finite dimensional representation theory of GLN. GLNC. Right. That's where we are now. That's where we are now computing. And so we need three invariant theory facts. Okay. The first one I've already, in some sense, I've already mentioned. If I take chi J0 evaluated on any matrix of size N, and chi J evaluated on any matrix of size M, then this is the trace of the tensor product of these two guys. Okay, so that's already, this is just the character of a tensor product is the product of the characters. That's all that is. So that's not even GLNC, that's just finite dimensional representation theory. The next fact is, though, a fact about finite dimensional representation theory of GLN, because it's going to tell me what happens when I do these sums. Okay? And it says, if I sum this over highest weights for GLM, but with everything non-negative, and such that the sum, the length is R of trace rho J0. This could be anything on GLN, and then rho J, anything on GLM, then that is in fact the trace of the Rth symmetric power of the tensor product of these guys. Okay, so this is now an N by N matrix, an M by N matrix. This is an NM by NM matrix, and I'm taking the Rth symmetric power of that matrix. This is, so SRD equals Rth symmetric power of D. Okay, so I can take it, it's the image of D and the Rth symmetric power of the standard representation. And then the third thing is what happens if I sum these. And this is very nice. So it says if I sum J1 up to Jm bigger than or equal to 0, trace something. Wait, I've lost something. Hold on. That, yeah. Oh, ha! I've already done this sum. Sorry. If I now sum on R equals 0 to infinity, because that's what the possible values of this can be, of the trace of the Rth symmetric power of the tensor product of two guys, and then x to the R, where x is, oh, is it R or minus R? That's a good question. It's probably minus R. No, it's probably plus R. See, now you see why I don't compute in front of you very often. X to the R, then this is the determinant of 1 minus X times this matrix. Inverse. Well, I just computed that sum for you, which computed that integral, and we get pi f w naught prime is the determinant 1 minus q to the minus s, because that's what r is here, right? This x, I'm in this formula, so x is q to the minus s. Right? So it's q to the minus s, that product. Inverse. And now, but in fact, we know a little bit more. These are diagonal matrices, right? So these, I mean, this is just the tensor product of two diagonal matrices. This is diagonal. This is diagonal. I'm taking the determinant of a diagonal matrix. So it's just the product of the entries. So this is the product. I equals 1 to n, product j equals 1 to n, 1 minus q to the minus s. So these are the characters for pi. These are the characters for pi prime. So one of these is n, one of these is m. Okay. So it's a product of one-dimensional L function. Okay. Now, for which facts? Oh, well, they could be in Hermann Weyl, and I mean they're stated like this in the in Jacquet and Schleicher. I bet they're in Goodman and Wallach's book on invariant theory. Anybody else have a reference? Hermann Weyl's classical groups. Maybe in Bump's book. Does he prove them, or does he do like I did? He probably does like I did. Oh, he doesn't do convolutions. Okay. All right. I'm not quite done, because what this says is this says that this particular integral has poles at all these places. Okay. Now the L function kills all these poles. So in terms of the L function, what this really says is that the L function has to divide this. However, let's write it in terms of these matrices. Yeah. Okay. So it says we get that. Yes. Now here I have it the other way. Oh, that's right, because this could have more poles than this. It has to kill exactly these, but it could have more. So the divisibility goes the other way. Sorry. So the determinant 1 minus q to the minus s a pi tensor a pi prime divides the L function when I view it as a polynomial. Okay. And now to get equality, what Jacquet and Schleicher do is they say to get equality, you just go back, and I told you from looking at the asymptotics what the maximal set of poles could be if you could compute those characters occurring, that x pi that occurs in the asymptotics of the Whitaker functions, the affinite functions. And if you compute those and what those possible poles can be, so in answer to your question, you get this. So it can't have any more poles than this from the asymptotics. From the asymptotics of the Whitaker functions. So, equality. So L S pi times pi prime is equal exactly to the determinant 1 minus q to the minus s. Computed the L function in terms either of the Satake parameters, if you like that, or by saying, well, the L function, I mean, the representations are just induced from characters, and I've computed them in terms of those basic characters. Okay. Now, let me draw two conclusions from this. Is this okay? Are we sort of okay with what I've done and where I've gone? In modulo, these facts about representation theory and the fact that I refuse to compute in front of you. This may be the first time I've proven anything. Here's two corollaries. Maybe? Oh, yeah, that's right. So for this, yeah, just take the bag. Yeah.
I think 2 is the heart.
So 2 is the heart. Yeah, well, that's the... yes. Well, in some sense, yeah, that's right. So that'll be the hard one. So, but I guess that's right. I guess if you just take these as being diagonal matrices and compute both sides, that could be elementary. Okay, so for the third fact, Ram is a reference. Right? So if you don't understand this, he said you could come ask him. Pardon me? Are y'all teaching? Are you teaching? Who's teaching calculus? Where's Katya? She teaches calculus. Even Katya didn't come today. Okay. Two corollaries. All right. Well, the first one is if I combine this calculation with the local functional equation, right? Because what does the local functional equation say? One of the things it says, if you take this, oh, and then this is important, that it is this integral. Because this is what we're really going to use, is the fact that the L function is precisely that integral. One version of the local functional equation says that this divided by this times the epsilon factor is the other side of the functional equation here divided by the other side of the functional equation here. But if both those ratios are 1, then the epsilon factor is 1. Okay? So the first corollary is that if pi and pi prime and this character psi are unramified, as above, then epsilon s pi times pi prime psi is identically 1. Okay. And then furthermore, if I take pi prime to be the trivial character of GL1, right, that's unramified, then I get that that epsilon s pi psi is also identically 1, which means, if I go back to the very beginning, if I write this in terms of the conductor, q to the minus f pi to the s, well, if this is 1, there's no s there, and so the conductor is 0. So there's at least part of the conductor theorem, the fact that if pi is unramified, its conductor is 0. Okay? That the exponent is 0. Okay. Now, so I'll let you work out the details of the local function equation, because the next corollary I give is quite important, and I think I have time to do it, and if not, I've never finished on time in my life, so it doesn't really matter now, does it? Okay, here's the second corollary. If pi is induced from mu1 down to mu n, is unramified and generic. So, for example, the unramified component of a cuspidal representation, then if I look at the Satake parameters, they're bounded above and below by q to the 1/2 and q to the minus 1/2. So this is a standard Jacquet-Shalika bound for the Satake parameters for GLN. Okay? All right. So all of the, for example, all of the, oh, is this true? What? Oh, okay, unitary. How's that? Are we happier now? Okay, right, they have to be unitary. You get strict. You get strict. Well, I'm going to give you the proof. So here's the proof. So actually, I have to use something that I didn't quite prove. The statement that I've done here, I did it for m less than n. Everything works for GLN times GLN. Okay? And there you have a Schwartz function, and the Schwartz function you take is just the characteristic function of the integer lattice. Calculation's exactly the same, basically. A little bit more involved, but not too much. Okay? So this is also valid, or this, I want to say this is valid if m is equal to n. Same thing here. And of course, you have to put the Schwartz function in. Okay. So the proof uses the GLN cross GLN unramified calculation for pi and its complex conjugate. Okay. And the point there is that if you look at the Satake parameters for the complex conjugate, it's just the Satake parameters for pi complex conjugate. You just complex conjugate those characters. And then what this calculation tells me is that if I take, so we're going to use this. If I take this and multiply it by this, that's one. Right? Now, unitarity, so this again, this goes back to these estimates on the Whitaker functions that I know I didn't give you complete details on, but one of the things we said was that if the representations were unitary, these integrals converged absolutely for real part of s bigger than or equal to 1. Well, but that means this thing can't vanish. So I am using a local non-vanishing statement. So 1 minus q to the minus s a pi tensor a pi bar is not equal to 0 for the real part of s bigger than 1, bigger than or equal to 1. Okay? But now this Remember, this is the product of all these linear factors, and in particular, one of these linear factors is the absolute value of mu squared. So this implies 1 minus q to the minus s, absolute mu I pi squared is not 0 for the real part of s bigger than 1, which says that the size of that better be less than q to the minus a half, or else I'm going to get a 0 here. So that's the upper bound. And then you do the same trick for pi contragradient, since the Satake matrix for the contragradient, the contragradient is given by taking the inverse of the characters. This gives omega I pi inverse is less than q to the 1/2, or mu I pi is bigger than q to the minus a half. Okay. So these bounds, in some sense, are purely local. Okay. And then these are still useful. These are still used. I mean, one of the ways to think about why the symmetric power L functions give you Ramanujan, if you know functoriality, is because you take a symmetric power, that means you've taken a cusp form on GL2, you've lifted it to GLN, you've essentially raised the Satake parameters to the, n minus first power, but then you apply these bounds. And you get the GL2 Satake parameters are less than, are bounded by Q to the 1 over 2 n minus 1. Yeah. I'm not saying they're not, but this is relatively elementary, and this... These are local bounds, yeah. They're purely local. But they do, combined with symmetric power functoriality, give you Ramanujan just based on these. I mean, they're still, in some sense, they are the basic bound for GLN. They're the basic bound for GLN. And they're a corollary of this calculation and this convergence statement. Okay. Yeah, it's just local. Yeah. But this, I mean, here we get it just from that one irreducible, the fact that generics are irreducible, unramified. Yeah, there are lots of ways to prove these, but this one is, I mean, in some sense, this is it as sort of a local L function method to give it. All right, next week I'm going to roughly show you what the local theory over R and C look like, okay? So it's just going to be sort of a tour of results, how the Archimedean places differ from the non-Archimedean places, what we know, what we don't. The next lecture, we're going to put it all together and prove all the basic properties of the global L function. We're going to take the Euler product, use all of our local results to get the global results. And then the lecture after that, we're going to turn everything on its head and state and prove the converse theorems. Okay? And then liftings. But we're almost there. We have the Archimedean stuff, the global stuff, and then the converse theorem. And we're gonna wind up using basically everything we've done. In particular, we need this calculation. We need this fact to derive the global theory from the local theory. So all these little things, I don't think I've done anything really extraneous. Most of what I've done we're gonna need for the global theory. Okay. On my watch, I finished a minute early, and I will take the credit for it. Don't look back there. Don't do it.